Case 99-764, State of Ohio versus Now Worthy.
Beyond that, the whole scheme was unconstitutional. In fact, all ready for the 4 a.m.
I'm a patient. Answer from our business. Yeah. I found that curious. I looked in the dictionary here. I didn't find any reference to the definition of predators that seemed to suggest it's only a four-legged animal or a carnivorous animal. It's a person, usually. And I was curious if the Court of Appeals had been in the case, particularly about the, referring to a person as a predator, which means they're some sort of a wild animal, which I don't find that any definition particularly as I read. I know that's not, I know you're not, but maybe you are tempted to support that argument about the Court of Appeals.
No, I believe that a human being can be soft and can victimize another human being and be a predator. I don't think it's limited to animals, and I don't think calling somebody a predator is defamatory, especially if it conveys the truth. The truth is a defense to domination, and somebody has victimized vulnerable victims over and over again.
Could the statute be constitutional vis-a-vis a facial challenge today and unconstitutional as applied at a later date?
Yes, that's certainly possible. As applied to a particular defendant who is being determined to be a sexual offender or a potential sexual offender, there's some procedural due process concerns and also some substantive due process. It doesn't like that.
Right. So if, in fact, we find that this is a facial challenge today, then we could find it constitutional on its face. But if we saw it being improperly applied, then you find it unconstitutional as applied. Does that affect anybody else then?
No, it's
so what did we saw?
If it's applied to a particular defendant at the appellate level, then that sets some case law and some guidelines perhaps for trial courts to follow later on, but it doesn't necessarily affect states for the labeled sexual predator in Portage County, unless the Court of Appeals finds that it's unconstitutionally applied to that defendant. That doesn't necessarily affect defendant in Hamilton County or in Franklin County. It does set some case law and give some ideas about how the law should be applied. And it is a new law, and of course, trial courts and courts still are fleshing this out. Just like the Senate Bill 2 issue, how do we apply these factors? And as more and more defendants are labeled sexually oriented offender or a sexual offender or a potential sexual offender, and those are appealed, we have some guidance. And hopefully, eventually, we'll get some uniformity to this. Or we're concerned about maybe one race being labeled a sexual offender. And Mr. Colson pointed out that there are other factors, whether that person is stalking, psychological evaluation, but this is going to be statewide. These factors are going to be applied statewide by different judges. And I believe it's going to take some time to flesh out how
the one we're looking at, constitutional issue. We're considering whether this is a proper exercise of police power. Would you address that?
When we're concerned about
this is a question, it involves a question of is it the proper exercise of the police power of the state?
A proper exercise of the police power is whether it's reasonably or rationally related to a legitimate government interest.
That's right.
The protection of higher citizens is a legitimate government interest, and the notification of the interest of rationally related to that, tell neighbors, tell schools, you tell police departments that somebody who is sexually oriented offenses or has a legal sexual predators in their midst, they need to be more careful. They can have a lookout. Okay.
public, but it's wrong to tell the public about it. It's fine for us to find out how deep the county engineer is going to put some sewer pipe, or find out what the county commissioners did on a ditch petition, but we aren't allowed to find out that there's a dangerous person living next door. And that notion is incredible.
Well, I'm doing this is always something more concerning. It's not just broadcasting what they already public information.
Well, the fact that someone is called a predator after having a conviction for rape or gross sexual imposition doesn't seem to me to add much of anything to the public perception that someone has.
Why do it? I mean, if that's meaningless, why do it?
Because those categories have particular meanings, and those are defined in the notice provided to citizens. Instead of saying rape or gross sexual imposition, which doesn't have a lot of meaning to a lot of people, this tells them this person is a predator. It's been found by a trial judge by clear and convincing evidence to pose a danger to the public.
Well, this person, the purpose of this hearing is to make an additional determination. And it is not. It would be insignificant to you if you were to focus on such a matter. It would be very significant.
That is true, Your Honor. But then the information conveyed to the public, before you ever get there, is certainly not as significant to get a rape conviction or any other sexual offense conviction. But then the information conveyed to the public as a result of this hearing is the person's name. That's shocking. Where he or she lives, that's available about all of us, and the crime he or she committed. That's available now in the county courthouse for the resource of the person who has the time to go down there from 8 to 4 in the daytime. That's not some secret information that we ought to be able, as a dangerous person, to lock away and have no one know. So I don't view that as something that's shocking and that I ought not know about my neighbors. As we're having our courts, our prosecutors, our public defenders engage in these cases, and then once they're resolved, we're supposed to lock it up in the courthouse and not tell anyone.
Well, but there's no government agency that puts your name and your address and your family, whatever you had, on the internet. There's no government agency that does that, like a sheriff's office. No difference.
Some sheriff's offices are making this available, and there's nothing wrong with that. Just as many clerks of courts on your own court are now making your orders and schedules available on the internet, so there's nothing wrong with making this information available to the public.
How do you respond to the defense's argument that by distributing this information, it impinges upon the rights of the defendant, buy property because they're a sexual predator, other things take place. How do you respond to that?
That has no effect on these people, in my view, no more so than the fact that they've incurred a conviction. People need to take responsibility for their actions, and they ought not be able to hide behind the fact that they've done these activities. We have a right to know, and just as your banker draws certain conclusions from your credit history, your colleges drew certain conclusions from your high school grades, every day people make judgments about us based upon our past. They aren't always positive. I might know my neighbor tried to commit suicide, or my other neighbor had a messy divorce. We draw conclusions from that. Often that has no impact upon us. For instance, the fact that someone committed a murder may not have any bearing on his ability to be a lawyer today.
Counsel, you opened the comments by saying, I don't understand what all this Constitution is going to do about you. Legislature can't just
such as this esteem very, very much, like those in New Jersey, New York, Washington State, and other states. After our Gowdy argument, I went back and looked at the statute in those cases, not just looking at the Gregoire case and the Bernier case, but pulling out those statutes. And they're very, very much like our own. The factors those other states consider at Federal Union are identical to our own. The notification in most cases is the same. And there are no constitutional problems with those statutes in those other states. Sure, there are privacy interests that bound up in constitutional principles that the government can't violate. There's information about veterans who've gone to VA hospitals. It would be wrong for the government to just put that information out on the internet. Perhaps the government has information about somebody's intimate marital relations for some reason. It's wrong to put that out. But the mere fact that someone has a name, lives in a certain address, and has a history of committing sex crimes, there's no privacy interest there. It's not bound up in any constitutional principle. And it's fine for us to go down to the courthouse and find out about what is going on in the courthouse. It ought to be fine for people to find out about these dangerous people living next to us.
Mr. Grumley, since this information, in your view, it's so much benign, do you have any thoughts about the advice we should give trial courts as to how they apply the factors of the statute in determining by clear and convincing evidence that a person is a sexual predator?
I can answer that, Your Honor. I first want to say I don't think this is a terribly difficult job. Our trial judges in our state and every state make difficult judgments every day. Many of them predictive judgments. Every time a bail is set in a case, judge is making a predictive judgment about whether that defendant is going to appear for trial or plea. We make predictive judgments in the trial court sentencing. Is prison more likely to be necessary to reform this person? The guidelines under the provisions in 96 spell all that out. So it isn't some novel provision in this statute alone that's requiring trial judges to make predictive judgments about human behavior. And it certainly isn't the case that this predator label is being applied willy-nilly to people. At the time of the Gowdy argument, I gathered numbers about how many predators there are in Ohio. At that time, 249 predators. That's it. And probably by now it's 260, 270, I don't know. But it isn't an overwhelming number, as opposed to 3,027 sexually oriented offenders. So the vast majority of people are falling into that latter category. And the General Assembly has given trial judges a very helpful set of criteria. Again, the self-same set of criteria that's used in New Jersey, New York, and other states. And with those, these trial judges are able to decide, with the government bearing the burden of proof, we acknowledge that and accept it. Government putting forward evidence, perhaps expert testimony, I think it'd be fine. They brought in experts who said, I've looked at this person's history, what he's done in prison, if he's been there before, and
so you really don't have any, you're not suggesting that we have any sort of, all of what you said is we'll trust the trial judge and it's fine if they want, somebody wants to bring an expert, but you don't have any recommendation for us as to how we, what law we should write as to what the trial courts need to consider in determining whether someone's a sexual predator.
I think
you don't have to. This is what
in my view, you don't need to do anything additional. You've got here a very specific set of criteria, and in bail hearings, you don't have those kinds of things here. You've got a whole wonderful list from the General Assembly of criteria that trial judges should consider. And sure, it's true in some cases, some of those aren't going to apply. You've got to have a general set of criteria if you're going to do this right. You can't boil it down so it applies to every case every time. So sometimes maybe the age of the victim isn't going to make a big difference, as you suggested earlier. But the trial judge can figure out which of those apply to the crime before him or her and make that predictive judgment based on clear and convincing evidence. If the government doesn't present the proof, fine. They shouldn't be classified as a predator. I have no problem with that.
Mr. Gormley, based on the law, is this case any different for us to decide than the first case?
Well, certainly the facial challenge to the Article 1, Section 1.
It's the same issue, isn't it? Same issue.
Same there. And in my view, there's nothing improper about the procedural posture of this case.
I didn't go into that. I didn't ask you that. Just to ask you, we've already argued all this in the first case, haven't we?
Yes.
Okay.
You have two suits before you, and you can resolve all the issues in both cases.
Thank you.
Mr. Harlan.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, before I begin, I have a question here for the court. Is there any time for a statement or not?
They will be given 30 seconds. They use their time to deal with the first 30 seconds to see if there are any questions.
This case, and I presented five broad assignments merit that the court has allowed also. I will recognize the decision of Cook to a very, very large extent, and I will make our oral argument a little easier because I recognize that with regard to the second, fourth, and fifth cross assignments merit, if Cook stands, then those cross assignments will not prevail, and they are really here to preserve the issues for further review later on. That's necessary. With regard to the, I'll call it the Williams argument, because that first case came in, that's been extensively discussed today. I'm not going to go through it again from A to Z, but I do have a few comments I'd like the court to consider based upon some things that have been said today. First of all, stated that in the number of years he's been a prosecutor, he's never seen someone commit a sexual offense one time. Well, in only 12 years of participating in defense work, I have seen people commit sexual offenses or sexually related offenses one time on many occasions. I have many such clients. And I don't think that if we're going to get into that at depth,
yeah,
we really need to get it into the record.
And even And of course, that's sort of even the inquiry is sort of beside the point to a facial challenge, isn't it? We're looking at whether the statute offends the Constitution, and particularly inalienable rights section of the Constitution, by its words, by its setup, by its framework. So, you know, who did and who didn't. My question, could I ask one about that subject now? Are you
finished?
Okay. It occurs to me that as we're talking about this, the difference, the gripe that is posed is that information that is otherwise available, albeit one used to have to go to the courthouse, one really had to expend a bit more effort. The only difference that this statute makes is that access is more available to information that's already out there. I mean, it really... You know, on the internet, it doesn't organize community stonings. It really says that if someone still has to make an effort to find it, too, I must say, until I studied for this case, I never had seen any printout of the kind of information that's available. But the point, I guess, the potential social consequences to an individual of this more available access is really... Isn't that also beyond our review? Because the state doesn't, I mean, are we saying the state is setting up potential social consequences? As one defense lawyer ably argued, people are being, they can't get mortgages. They can't, you know, that this results from more available access. Is that something we should be concerned about? The statute just says access.
Yes, Your Honor. And to answer that question properly, you covered a lot of ground in that question. So I'm going to have to address several parts of what you said. First of all, I stood here probably a few minutes ago and told you I wasn't going to go back into Cook to answer that question. Actually, just a little. There's one part of Cook, and I didn't participate in that case. I have no idea. I know what the case said, but I don't know what was brought to the attention of the court and what was argued. Okay? But there's one part of Cook I had strongly
And that's consequential, a consequential difference?
Mark, my co-owners, secondly, we're providing pictures. Something occurred yesterday that I have to bring up, and I wish I would put it in my group, but I couldn't because I didn't know about it. There are rigs associated with this statute. I would invite the court, even though I didn't do so in my brief, please look at those rights when we're making this review. Because I think you'll find.
The rights adopted by who?
Sorry, I didn't look at it. This, like I said, this came to my attention about 11 o'clock yesterday. Apparently, there are rights. They're mentioned in one of the cases that are cited in the briefs, although they're not really part of the argument. And I think if you look at those, you'll find.
Where do you find them? In what code do you find them?
Administrative code. Cited in one of the amicus briefs. I apologize for having been cited.
Criminal, in the Ohio Administrative Court Code, criminal regulations?
No, no.
Oh, because it's the
not regulations, because it's dissemination of information of this statute.
Is a sexual predator hearing a criminal action or a civil action?
So far, this court has found it to be a criminal or a civil action.
Okay.
Except that we have appointed counsel, of course. We got this impression that we have this very narrow, and this is related to the rational relationship to a legitimate state purpose aspect of the case. We found this narrow, very narrow intrusion into the rights, obviously, in Williams, the 11th District, disagreed with the breadth of the intrusion. And in fact, being a smoker, I've been relegated to going into the stairwell at my office. I was out there yesterday talking to my law firm about this case. And one of my partners, Pamela Adams, who knows nothing about criminal law, sat down for the same purpose. She says to me, I got one of those notices in the mail. Tells me all about it and says, what struck me is funny is I live in Bay Village. And this gentleman that they're notifying me about could not possibly live any further away from me and still be in Bay Village. He's at least 6 miles away. Why am I being notified? I don't think that I realize this is a difficult case. All these cases are difficult because, for one thing, and I sort of believe this from the prior oral arguments, we really, none of us, myself, the court, prosecuting attorneys, may really have all of the information in front of us that we'd really like to have. But I think the very narrow intrusion contemplated in the book is not, in fact, what's going on. The court, several justices, I believe, have questioned concerning about, are we not finding anybody to be a sexual predator? In my experience, I spoke to Mr. Draper recently. There's one case in Cleveland where that's happened. I'm personally aware of one case in Trumbull County where that's happened, although I don't claim to understand what's going on all over the state. I've been quite a bit of work in Northeast Ohio, and those are the only two I'm aware of where someone is found not to be a sexual predator. But even testing here. Your Honors, also in one of the briefs, and I think I still didn't do it.
Maybe this isn't a fair question either. Would that be because the statute on its face is overly broad? Or is that because this is such a
bunch of bad people?
The enormous downside potential is to a judge who says someone from presenting the facts isn't.
But we can only concern ourselves with the first
one.
Yes. So I don't think we should bury our heads just in the second one. We don't do these things in total bad. But yes, legally, certainly. Your Honors, earlier today, we've heard about recidivism. And I think here again, this plays into the analysis of rational aid to a legitimate purpose. Can we lessen the impact of Article 1, Section 1? Our Constitution that way. These studies that I have read in support of both the national appeal you. Our statute goes way beyond pedophilia. Our statute goes way beyond sex crimes.
But having done so, how does that render it unconstitutional? It doesn't match the others, but we need a basis, I mean, one of your bases for finding it unconstitutional on that, because it's broader.
Article 1, Section 1 is a constitutional basis. This court, if it accepts the standard set forth by the state, which, and all of the appellees' reasons we don't necessarily agree with, but if it accepts that, you have to find a rational relationship with a legitimate purpose. If the basis of our analysis starts out with pedophilia, how do we get to a kidnapper of an adult with no sexual contact whatsoever?
Yeah.
Well, but the basis doesn't have to begin with pedophilia, that's the constitutional.
I'm sorry?
The basis does not have to, is not required by the Constitution to be pedophilia.
No, but the actual basis was that you're looking for state purpose. What are we trying to do here? And here's how we're doing it. And are those two things narrowly tailored enough to pass a rational basis test?
I think your stronger argument, frankly, is to apply Benjamin and Troy, that the statute perhaps goes beyond what's necessary to meet the state's interest here, particularly in view of the other states that have statutes that are apparently are more restrictive than our carefully listed cases.
I agree, Your Honor. I sort of got sidetracked, but I think I gave a misimpression of what
takes you off. I'm sorry about this.
What point I was trying to make with that, when the recidivism was mentioned earlier, I really don't think it plays into his argument at all. I'm only trying to counter something that the court was presented with, and I would ask you to do that with a grain of salt, because the high recidivism we're talking about is limited to that field.
Do you even have a constitutional issue of the Article 1 argument? If it is not self-executing, as the state argues, of course, do we then? And there has to be some way for a court to determine whether the state has violated the rights that are the Precatory Statement of Rights in Article 1. Do we then look at the due process clause? Is that how we get to deciding whether the state has abridged those rights that are stated in Article 1?
I think it's a parallel examination with regard to the self-executing argument. I have two big problems with that. First of all, I don't think this court has ever found a portion of the Ohio Bill of Rights to be non-self-executing. Second of all, and that's what we're talking about here, second of all, even this court has found that even if the statute or a constitutional provision is not self-executing, you can't have legislation, mere legislation, that actually contradicts it.
Well, you could, but there's no question that legislation can be adopted that can regulate or, in some ways, limit a person's right to be happy and all the things that are here that are stated in Article 1. So then we have a task. What do we have to apply? What are the limits on the state's right to affect those Article 1 rights?
I believe that the 11th District provided a rather detailed analysis of how they did that. I think the test is, is this exercise of police power too intrusive beyond what is necessary? What does that mean? There are a lot of cases they cited that try to explain that. And I think the final part of their analysis is perhaps the most instructive in that they're saying, you look at other cases and what are they done? And then, you look at the facts of the world, the law that you're looking at itself, and say, gee, is there another way to do the same thing that's less intrusive? And I think, as a practical matter, that's a good approach. Your Honor, before I totally run out of time, there is one point I'd like to touch in the cross-assignment sphere. I recognize that the 11th District made no ruling on these. All of these were presented to the 11th District Council. And I appreciate the court allowing me to bring with regard to the void for vagueness argument, I have to, with all due respect, disagree, especially with the Attorney General Office and most attorneys who have done a silly argument. This is a very real it impacts both the trial court. And one of the things that the trial court is supposed to consider, which is expert testimony concerning the subject. I know this is an ideal situation. I'm not familiar with the third case, so I'm not sure what the court has in front of it by way of a record. But if you look at these, and may I finish my
question? Yes,
if you look at these reports that you're getting, okay, by these mental health professionals, what you see is an effect similar to what has been alluded to about a trial court. Gee, I don't want to say somebody's not a sexual predator because it could have ramifications. What was happening with the mental health professionals is they're bringing into that word lightly. They're saying, look, if all I got to do is say lightly, it's very difficult not to. This is a murder proof. These two parts of the statute have to be read in comparative jury act. You have to have clear and convincing evidence. Okay?
And recidivism is not in the factors. It's in the definition, but it doesn't appear to be in the factors unless you want to say the pattern is a recidivism point, but it really isn't among the factors of courts to consider. It's only in the definition.
No, but that comes up in the psychological courts every time they look at existence of or lack of.
Well, they have to find it, sure.
And if this likelihood, you have this clear convincing evidence of likelihood, this court, in an old case versus Holt, said that likelihood is less than probability. Less than probability. How do you have clear convincing evidence of less than a probability? It's incomprehensible to me, a trained attorney.
I'm not before you sit down. You raised early on this issue of some great relationships that you have to do. I'm not sure that you closed on what you wanted to tell us about those regulations or what you wanted us to consider.
I think that the only reason those were brought up, Your Honor, in Cook, the precise holding was this is a punishment. Okay? Along the way, a lot of things were said that lead over into these cases. One of the things that it says is that it leads over into these cases is that. You know, this is sort of a minimal notification. These are the only people that are being told. I think if you look at the regs, you find out that your question was that what you previously talked about that.
In other words, it's a dissemination of the information is broader under the regs.
Yes.
Then it would appear as we do.
Yes, because the statute basically is that this regulatory authority set up regs about dissemination. They've done that. It's going down all over here. Just one last sentence with regard to the, the clear convincing evidence of likelihood, what that is to me. Okay, we're
making it tough.
We don't think this likeness is the legislature. For you to be a sexual predator, there has to be clear and convincing evidence. Your Honors, with the word likelihood in there, what you have is a tough eggshell.
Ms. Norman, you've used your time. It's going to take 30 seconds.
Just a couple of things. This court in Cook said that protecting Ohio citizens from a paramount governmental interest, which I believe is another way of saying it's a compelling government interest, and that the statute is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. So even if we use the strict scrutiny or the bullet assessment, says that along constitutional lines, it doesn't interfere with rights beyond the necessities of the situation. I believe this court in Cook has already decided that. The necessities of the situation, protecting Ohio citizens from sexual predators in conforming government. And that is an example that asks this court to reverse the decision of court of appeals where they will stand for the judgment of the jury to be called essential.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Thank you.
All right.